This podcast was recorded before Radiohead informed the world they were releasing their new album on Sunday the 8th of May. Thanks, Radiohead.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, where we cram a week's worth of pop culture into 59 minutes of high-quality discussion, digression, and argument. My name is Andrew Harrison, and with us today are writer Paul Denoyer, co-founder of both Q and Mojo magazines, author of books on the music of London and his hometown Liverpool, on Paul McCartney, John Lennon, and the great lost art rock band Deaf School, and also a veteran of the late Great Word magazine. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Andrew.
Hello. Also with us is journalist, internet person, and reformed musician, no relation to Catelyn Moran, it's Michael Moran. Michael is a veteran of Mixmag, The People Online, and also The Word magazine. Hello, Michael.
Good morning, Andrew. Good morning, listeners.
You were just telling us before we got started about your experiences with Lemmy's microphone.
In a rehearsal studio, you know, you're quite often sort of shoveled in immediately after somebody else has just come out, and you know, certain things like mics and stuff are left up. And I don't know how I managed to draw the short straw, because I wasn't the singer in the band, but I ended up with Lemmy's mic for my backing vocals.
And what was Lemmy's mic like?
Stank.
It stank.
No, it's an adjective now. It was stank.
It was stank.
It was Tony Stank.
A powerful sense memory of Lemmy.
I'm not quite sure. It was kind of miasma of stale bourbon, fags, and just general, like, cheesy old man teeth.
Yeah, so Ode to Lemmy.
Not good.
Okay.
But, you know, he was a lovely man, and he was kind to animals.
Excellent.
But he stank.
Also with us, twiddling the knobs as ever, it's Matt Hall. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Andrew.
Hello. Right, well, you've got to keep your wits about you these days. If you blink, you'll miss another exciting new record coming out. This week, Radiohead first caused widespread panic amongst pallid indie kids by deleting their entire internet presence, no Facebook, no Twitter, no nothing, and replacing it with an image of a tweeting bird. Then, without much warning, they put up a remarkable video for their new track, Burn the Witch. This is the first single from their new 9th album, which we think is going to be called Dawn Chorus. The video mixes Chigley and the Wicker Man, and surprisingly for Radiohead, the tune itself is quite good fun. Let's have a listen. So that was not the opening title to the Great British Bake Off. That was Burn the Witch by Radiohead, their brand new track, surprise release. This caused much grinding of teeth amongst the world of music critics, who had to spit out instant reaction articles and reviews with little or no warning. With all these kind of stealth releases, do we end up focusing on the marketing and the nature of it being a surprise more than the music?
I think the idea of a record being a surprise is starting to get a bit old. I mean, I quite like this record. I'm well disposed to it. I think it's the second really good Bond theme in a row they've released. but the kind of look at me announcement of it, or non-announcement of it, I thought it's just a bit of a played out idea now for me.
It's kind of it's a don't look at me, isn't it? It's like, yeah, we're doing it, but we're not really doing it. And that, you know, Paul, what did you think of it as a record? Did you enjoy it as a...
Well, my initial reaction was that Half Man, Half Biscuits, our old favourites, have got to sue.
Absolutely.
You know, the creators of the Trumpton Riots are seeing their genius repeated and introduced.
Keep Mrs. Honeyman right out of sight, yes.
The central conceit is very Trumpton Riots.
Yes.
As people will understand when they see the video. I think, I kind of liked the record, as I kind of like most Radiohead records, but I just find the video for me overwhelmed the music.
Yeah.
Now, even now, after hearing it 5 times, I can't quite remember the record, but I remember every single detail of this quite extraordinary, splendid video that they've made to go with it.
It's also quite similar to quite a lot of the stuff that Super Furry Animals did in terms of their animations.
Yeah.
It's a very, you know, taking kind of a very childish stuff and putting the burning skulls and the kind of...
Yeah. What I liked about it was it's pretty much the first ever Radiohead joke. It's the first time they've ever done anything funny that's quite likeable, which I thought was just was lovely. And also, I mean, spoiler alert, but there is a happy ending. In the little sort of post-music bit, you see the little wooden Edward Woodward.
Yes.
Edward Woodward. Yeah. He lives. He doesn't burn to a crisp.
Best jokes but ever, of course.
Unfortunately, there wasn't a little wooden Samuel L. Jackson coming out in a kind of post-credit sequence to say... I'd like to join the shared Trumpton Chigley universe
with Radiohead. Is the Wicker Man also itself a little bit done to death? This has been something that's in the whole world of acid folk. You know, the Wicker Man is cited over and over again.
I don't know. I saw it at a really pivotal age when I was at a boarding school out in the countryside. I think I saw it when I was 11.
Yes,
out at a boarding school, to me, that really shaped my whole notion of what happens outside London.
Yes.
It was my first week of being out in the country.
Is it not what happens outside London?
No, it absolutely is.
It's a documentary.
It's a warning from history.
Focusing back on the song, Radiohead sort of were this, they wear it very heavily, this kind of burden of being the modern group that means stuff, the modern group that with great import. And yet you have to wonder, as is often the case with their record, what exactly are you trying to say here?
Well, I don't know if I'm just leaping to the too obvious conclusion, but I looked at the video and thought, Trumpton.
Yeah.
Hello, Trump, Donald Trump.
Ah.
Very well timed in that sense, just as he ascends to the, the Republican coronation and all of that. And there seems to be some sort of parable about the dark underside of populism and nativist nostalgia and so on going on in the video, unless I'm completely misreading it.
Yeah, it's along those lines. It also struck me as, you delete your entire internet presence and then you do a song with accompanying video that's about mob rule. It seemed to be as much about the oppressive nature of the internet and social media and the fact that nobody can say anything without a murder of crows descending upon them and tearing them to bits. And they managed to make quite a good gag out of it, I thought, which is tricky.
There are quite a few witty little touches in the video, and I enjoyed it very much. I mean, whether I'll enjoy it very much in the future, I don't know. But jokes like the seesaw that's half of a docking stool.
Yes.
Yeah. The flower bedecked maypole that turns out to be a gallows. In a grim way, these are very witty touches.
Yes.
The man who's painting the post box red, and next thing he's painting red crosses on the
the
doors, just like those migrants' doors, isn't it?
Yes.
It's funny in a fairly dark, macabre kind of way.
And it's quite Scarfic as well, isn't it? Scarfic.
Yeah,
if you're not familiar with Scarfic, the fictional 1970s county council on the internet, where they put up public information warnings about the danger of getting rabies from babies and things like that.
Which is, in fact, only a shade darker than the actual public information films of the 70s.
Absolutely, yeah. It's hauntological public information films. One of the ironies of this whole Radiohead thing is that it went straight to YouTube, which Tom York has condemned as apparently stealing art like Nazis during the Second World War, and it went straight to Spotify.
Why didn't
he
get the Ken Livingstone treatment?
Perhaps we can come on to this. It also went straight onto Spotify, which Tom York famously referred to it as the last fart of a dying corpse. Are they being slightly hypocritical here, putting this record out on the platforms that Tom York has condemned? So,
do they have any options?
Yeah, it's like if you can't beat them, you have to join them.
Well, Prince is winning that battle, isn't he?
Good it's doing him. Yeah. Yes.
No, but physical sales, the way you always get that post-mortem bounce, like commercially speaking, his post-mortem bounce is all physical sales because it's not available in any other platform.
But isn't that what Radiohead do? They make a big fuss about releasing things via BitTorrent or download that you have to meet a bloke around the back of the pub at 11 o'clock to get the kind of code for and stuff. Mm. But then, after all the fuss, they come out in physical form and they win Grammys for the design of the physical
object. £50
so,
physical object.
Yeah, yeah, so, they do it both ways. They get the real big PR push for doing something kind of new and different that nobody else has ever done before, and then they
flog the merch. It's only what rock stars have done since time immemorial, actually. It's having your cake and eating it, basically.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's being funky and fiscal simultaneously.
Yeah. Well, I like the fact that they will do these surprise things, and Beyonce does it, and other people do it as well. And I think it does bring some excitement back into the world because you literally have to, keep your eye on every timeline going. But unfortunately, it's presented as the way forward for music, and you can only do this if you're already Radiohead, with 15 years of a major label behind you, marketing you in a very, very conventional sense, developing you in a very, very conventional sense. This is not a recipe or a magic bullet for Joe Schmo's band.
Well, when Billy Nomates, musician, puts something up on Bandcamp...
Yes.
I have released several dozen records that...
You are Billy Nomates, yes.
Unwanted, unexpected...
Yes.
And unnecessary.
You launched them as a surprise release into the social media.
And in that sense, I see myself very much as an innovator.
Yeah, you were doing it all just to kind of explore the...
The outer reaches of what's not wanted in pop.
Okay, well, apart from these stealth digital releases, this week saw something pretty exciting in the oldest of old media, books. Philip Norman's new book, Paul McCartney, the biography, is billed as the first Macca biography written with McCartney's approval and cooperation. Norman, of course, wrote the famous Beatles biography Shout, which is thought by many to be the standard work. He also wrote John Lennon, The Life, as well as biographies of the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger and Buddy Holly. Up to now, he's been seen very much as a Team Lennon man. Shout was accused of depicting McCartney as a great manipulator, and in many ways, Norman is responsible for the current consensus that Lennon was the visionary art guy and McCartney was somehow this base and commercially minded entertainer. Paul, with us, is the author of Conversations with McCartney, and he's knows his Macca inside out. So before we talk about Philip Norman's book and the place of Macca in pop culture now, let's have a listen to the Lennon versus McCartney song written by Macca as an attack on Lennon. This is You Never Give Me Your Money from Abbey Road.
You never give me your money. You only give me your funny paper. And in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all good children go together.
That was up-and-coming band The Beatles there, and You Never Give Me Your Money. Paul, can you set the scene a bit regarding, you know, Philip Norman and The Beatles and his relationship with them? How did he come to be the kind of favoured historian?
Philip Norman was a very eminent Sunday Times journalist in the 60s and the 70s, and he covered The Beatles back in the day. And at some point in the 70s, he wrote a poem in the Sunday Times, which became quite legendary in Beatles circles. It's an absolutely savage personal attack on Paul McCartney. The last lines of it are, O deified scouse with unmusical spouse, for the cliches and cloy you unload, to an anodyne tune may they bury you soon in the middlemost midst of the road.
Oof.
That's just one of the kinder stanzas of this. 4 years later, he published his book Shout, the one of the biggest, most nearly definitive Beatle biographies. And it is very much, as you say, Team John.
Kind of one of the biggest music biographies, rock music biographies ever, really, isn't it?
Yes, and when they weren't as common as they are these days. And it was coming from the mainstream. He was a Sunday Times guy. He wasn't an NME hack like me or something. He was a proper journalist. And it was a well-respected book. But I think it probably, as you say, it did quite a lot to form the consensual view that McCartney was a bit of a lightweight and John was the seeker after truth and the artistic daredevil and so forth. Then a few years later, quite a few years later, Philip Norman followed up with a massive book about John Lennon, which had the cooperation of Yoko. Much to Philip's surprise, Paul McCartney agreed to do a little interview. And from this point on, relations began to thaw. And Philip Norman then thought, I'll see if McCartney will let me do a biography of him. And McCartney gave him tacit approval. In other words, McCartney gave him a very, very quick interview and put the word out that nobody would be kneecapped for talking to Philip Norman. So a few of Paul's friends have spoken to Philip Norman on the record for the book. And the book is... it's a road to Damascus conversion, actually, from being the most vehement anti-McCartneyite. Philip Norman is now the most enthusiastically pro-Paul voice you can imagine.
So how much of that entails him recanting what he previously said and essentially saying, well, you know what I told you in 1973? I didn't really mean it.
To give him his due, he does come clean at the very beginning in the intro. He quotes a little bit of that poem that I've just quoted to you, and he says, yes, I loved Paul. I had a real crush almost on Paul McCartney in the 60s. And then I felt terribly disillusioned by the music he was making afterwards, whereas I was swept along by the image of John Lennon. But he doesn't really explain why he tugged against McCartney so deeply. All we can say is that he spotted an opportunity
spotted a live Beatle, I think, is what he's trying to say.
It wouldn't have been possible for him to write this book, I think, if he hadn't kind of come round to McCartney. There's quite a lot of rewriting of his own opinions in the book. But then that's fair enough. We all change our opinions over time, and maybe Philip has genuinely come round to see the validity of McCartney's music and to understand the point that McCartney himself makes a lot. That back in the 60s, he was the one doing most of the avant-garde experimentation, although he was just doing it at home with a tape recorder, whereas John was copying these ideas and putting them onto actual Beatle records in tracks like Tomorrow Never Knows.
Mm. Is it a good read?
It is a good read. It's a long read. It's nearly 1,000 pages. But Philip Norman is a, you know, he's a good journalist from the quality end of Fleet Street. So he knows how to do interviews and how to marshal his material. He knows how to tell a good story, basically. He's not an academic. It reads very well.
Mm. Were there surprises in there?
There's not a great deal that's new, actually. I mean, I suppose I am the kind of person who reads almost everything. Mm. The bar is being set higher and higher now by Mark Lewison, who is in stages bringing out the complete results of his research into the Beatles. Mm. Mark Lewison's series of books are just about the Beatles, but they're so dense that they outstrip even solo biographies of the four individual members. Mm. And there is almost nothing you can say now that hasn't already been, of the early years, that hasn't already been covered in more detail by Mark Lewison. Mm. There are one or two interviews here which are new to me. I think Philip must have done these himself with people like John Eastman, who was Linda's brother, Paul's brother-in-law, and one of the Eastman legal family who took over Paul's business affairs in the big showdown with Alan Klein and Apple. So there's a few things which are new to me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you've met Macca loads of times. Did he ever give any sense of kind of resenting this, you know, what we could probably call the Liam Gallagher position? John was the clever one and Macca was just the one who made the pretty tunes. Does he resent that?
I think it really cut him up. I've interviewed Paul loads and loads of times, 30-odd times, but it was all after the death of John Lennon, post-1980, and therefore Paul was in that invidious position whereby he could never speak openly about how much he resented the posthumous deification of John Lennon, because it would look so ungracious if he did.
Yeah.
He's always had to tread a very fine line. He's had to kind of let it be known that actually he was really hip and he knew some really groovy people in the 60s when John was still living in the suburbs with Cynthia and their child, Julian. At the same time, he can't overdo it because it just looks bad, doesn't it?
Yeah, and even little tiny things like the reversal of the credits that happened a few years ago. There's a couple of Lennon-McCartney tunes, wasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, if I'd been advising Paul, I would have said, just drop all that. It's not going to look good. Mm. And he did drop it eventually. His argument is that they never did settle on the order of Lennon and McCartney in the old days, and they used to switch it back and forth. Mm. And then it became kind of set in stone by Parlophone at a certain stage. Mm. But no, not worth pursuing, I would have thought.
Yes. Well, he's worked incredibly hard to kind of own the Beatles' legacy himself, hasn't he? But also to kind of strongly push his own solo work. You know, he tours in a way that no sensible 73-year-old should do.
Yeah, there's one poignant quote in the Philip Norman book, actually, which, again, I haven't come across before. At some point in the 80s, not long after John had died, Paul is supposed to have said to a close friend, well, you know, that's typical bloody John Lennon. You know, he's died a legend. I'll just die an old man. Mm. In other words, you know, John has beaten me once again. That, as it transpires, I don't think that's going to be quite the case, because the sheer success of the sheer length of McCartney's later career has allowed him, as you say, to kind of own the Beatles' memory. Mm. John is slowly, imperceptibly fading now from memory, I'm afraid. Mm. But McCartney is announcing another date in another Midwest Enormo Dome every single day this month. He is just out there constantly, and for a good proportion of the world's population, Paul McCartney actually is the Beatles.
Well, when we all worked on the Word magazine, there was a recurring thing we noticed, which was that when young people discovered the Beatles, and so 17 or 18, they'd go out and they'd look for the Beatles album where the Beatles looked like the Beatles on the front, and they would choose Let It Be, where everybody was hairy and cool, and they'd get it home and they'd get a terrible shock because it wasn't the Beatles they were expecting. Do you think this book is going to change other generations' ideas of what the Beatles were and what they stand for?
Philip Norman's new book, I think, is too much of a conventional account of the Beatles to really change anybody's perceptions of them. What Philip has tried to do conscientiously is pull back some of the attention onto Paul's post-Beatle career. You know, the typical Paul McCartney book is 90% about the Beatles, and it's as if everything ends in 1970. Yeah. And there's a quick gallop through Wings and the solo years, and Philip redresses the balance. It's about 50% Beatles and 50% later. Yeah. But of the latter stuff, And this is where you get your big, fat Daily Mail serialisations from, which my kind of book never will, unfortunately. He gets them from long accounts of the Heather Mills court case.
Yes.
And long accounts of the brief period of a year or two when Paul was single and he was Paul McCartney of the Beatles. Mm. He could basically shag any girl he wanted. Mm. He found it very difficult not to shag any girl. It was almost impossible. He couldn't get out the driveway of his house in St. John's Wood. You know, so he had a kind of frisky couple of years there. Mm. And Linda, before she settled down with Paul, she was a bit of a lively lass herself. Mm. But none of this is scandalous and none of this is unknown.
Yeah.
And, you know, once they married, they were very happily, faithfully married for a very, very long time.
You mentioned earlier that he doesn't really get credit for being the avant-garde chap that that he has been, largely from doing it all in his shed and not putting it out. Famously, he wanted to record yesterday with the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, which I would have loved to have heard. Amongst Macca's later more free-ranging moments was an experimental album with the renowned dance producer and former Killing Joke bassist Youth. Electric Arguments was released in 2008 under the name The Fireman. Here is Nothing Too Much, Just Out of Sight. Was Nothing Too Much, Just Out of Sight by The Fireman, a.k.a. the Paul McCartney and Youth from Killing Joke blues explosion. Mike, you had some thoughts about that while I was playing?
Well, I was saying that it's not so much the sheer length of his career, because there are, you know, as we've said, other artists who have had such long careers, but it's the scope of his ambition throughout that length.
Yeah.
So the Stones decided a while ago they were now going to become a Stones tribute band, and they're a very good Stones tribute band, but they're a jukebox outfit. And, you know, Aretha Franklin, similarly, is still doing sterling work, but it's doing sterling work that harks back to our older days. Paul McCartney is still trying to find new things to do, which I find incredibly admirable.
And has, you know, that massive interest as well. That when he played Glastonbury, it was the one time in the last kind of like 4 or 5, maybe 10 years ago, when was it, that I actually left the front of the kind of main arena before the main artist came on, because it was just such a massive crowd there. Mm. Bigger than Beyonce, can I say?
Macca, bigger than Beyonce. You're listening to Big Mouth with me, Andrew Harrison, with Matt Hawley. You just heard Paul Denoyer and Michael Moran. The Beatles. So everybody loves the Beatles, don't they? Absolutely everybody in the world. Well, not always. Sometimes you can accept that a band is fantastic. I would never be so stupid as to say the Beatles aren't fantastic. But you can still not like them very much, not get much of an emotional response to them, maybe. Are there acclaimed artists that you just don't get? And can you force yourself to get a band? Am I wrong to not really like the Beatles? Mike, who are the bands you're supposed to like that you just don't get?
Well, certainly a great many people of my generation like the Smiths.
Yes.
Now, at the very moment that people were turning onto the Smiths and saying, yeah, this is the stuff, you know, when you're, as a younger man, you sometimes have these little whimsical ideas about popular music and its destiny.
Yes.
My whim at that time, and bear in mind I was in my early 20s, so I think I'm forgiven for being something of an idiot, is that I believe that guitar groups were done. I'd made the Dick Rowe mistake, that I thought it was all over for guitar bands. And the future now was really people with turntables and synthesizers, ideally from New York, you know, ideally called Afrika Bambaataa. Mm. And that was it. That was the future of rock. So when this guitar band sprung up and there were like four white guys from Manchester playing music that didn't speak to me or to my desires.
Did it say nothing to you about your life?
Nothing at all.
Ah.
It wasn't enough for me not to like them. I got up early in the morning to hate them that bit more.
See, I can fully understand people not liking the Smiths because they're almost designed to be a love or hate proposition, aren't they? And the fact that people hate them makes me like them more. Something like the Beatles is supposed to be a universal proposition. Even I understand that they did everything.
But the thing with the Beatles, I'm like, so you and me are of a different generation to Paul, am I allowed to say that?
Absolutely.
And I don't know about your household, but my household was wall-to-wall Beatles growing up in the Northwest during the kind of late 60s, early 70s. And I rapidly, when I started listening to music, thought, I've actually heard all this lot. This has become like wallpaper. It's so, I know every note of it.
And you want something that's your own thing.
And you want something that's your own thing. But even now, you know, I hear that stuff that I didn't know particularly, like that Abbey Road track, and it's kind of like
just sounds like the Beatles.
Yeah.
Paul, are there bands in the canon that you just don't get?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not so sure that we... I don't think we live in this world anymore of you should like this and you shouldn't like that. Mm. I don't know whether that kind of consensus with the wagging finger is really overshadows us in the way that it used to. Mm. I can remember most of my life feeling ashamed that I didn't like jazz more. You know, yeah. I have sat in darkened rooms with Charlie Parker albums and Miles Davis albums, willing myself to like this music and feeling ashamed that I come to the end of the session.
Yeah.
None the wiser, actually.
Had you been taking heroin?
Maybe that's where I went wrong. I ended up just kind of, what's the old Lenny Bruce? I love the clothes and the attitude, but I couldn't. But the actual sound it makes, the noise these people make.
I was then convinced that jazz is a bit like smoking. That it's pretty unpleasant the first half a dozen times you try it.
Yeah.
You've just got to power through.
Yeah.
Is it as good for you to smoke
it? Yeah. Well, I think, looking at the outcomes for some of the top jazz chaps, no.
Yes, I can say that. Paul, do you think it might be that... Because I sat down and made myself listen to AC/DC because everybody I know loves them. Yeah. And lots of the bands I know love them and steal from them gleefully. So AC/DC, they're supposed to be a good thing. They've got a great logo. They've got a guitarist dressed as Nigel Molesworth. What could be better? And I've sat down, I've forced myself. And at the end of it, I had to admit, I hate this. I really, really hate this. It's everything I don't like.
Yeah.
I don't
hate them, but I admire, one thing I admire about AC/DC, as I would admire Motorhead and the Ramones, is that they are bands which transcended their music.
Yeah.
They became T-shirts. Mm. And their appeal is reborn to every generation.
I wonder if it's any coincidence that they found a trick and then stuck with it, all those three bands.
Yeah. Yes, they did. But they had a kind of visual identity that can be boiled down to a logo as well. And, you know, models can wear these things on the catwalk, and it just says, rock chick. It just says so much.
Yeah.
And that kind of keeps the reputation of the band's buoyant, regardless of the...
Well, we get to the sight of David Beckham in a Crass T-shirt. It's going a bit far, though, isn't it, really? I would love to sit him down with Stations of the Crass and just see what he thought of it.
There are a lot of these key influential artists that aren't very digestible. They just aren't. You know, so Pavement, I'm a big meh on Pavement, but I like Blur a great deal. Mm. You know, I can't really be bothered with Terry Riley, but I like David Bowie.
Yeah.
You know, there are bands that they need to be pre-chewed by somebody who understands them before you can get into them.
I like Ian McNabb and I can't stand Neil Young, which makes no sense. That's like saying I like tofurkey, but I don't like actual turkey.
No, I think that's legit.
Actually, Ian McNabb's not tofurkey. He's proper. He's good. He's the next generation thing, isn't he?
It's a bit like my favourite Smith single is that one that Soho did.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because I loved them so much. They got the Moran Kiss of Death. It's a band I really like. They're Doomed. Mm. And I doomed Soho by loving them so very much. There are musics that you can tell. Like, I really like Van de Graaff Generator because I was there. Now, my wife is a good deal younger than me. I wouldn't even bother trying to get her into it. I just know that it's a waste of time. But similarly, the Beatles were a bit before my time. And then in the 70s, when I was actually interested in music, I was all prog all the time because that's what was going on at my school and nobody really played Beatles records. Then I briefly was all punk rock. We hate the Beatles because that's a slogan. And then it was probably the 80s that I first actually heard the White Album all the way through. It blew my mind. It was brilliant.
Yeah.
I really liked it. So some music will last. And a lot of it, good as it is for right now, you know... It's for right now.
I remember reading an Ian McDonald's book. I think it was a quote from Billy Bragg saying he read this book and he listened to the Beatles for the first time properly. And much as they're not, you know, my favourite thing, after reading Revolution in the Head, I understood it more and realised, you know, that many of the reasons I didn't find it attractive were kind of bogus. When you see it in context, it makes a lot more sense. Who do we think, though, are the critically acclaimed acts who really should be kicked out of the canon, knocked off the pantheon? I'm going with The Doors. Overrated, annoying, basically a student bedroom poster blown up above its station.
The Doors are only a problem, though, if you take them seriously.
Yeah.
My attitude to The Doors is that they're a pop group. That was how I first heard them, and I was very young. They'd have singles that were on Pick of the Pops or something. So before I even saw a photograph of them or, heaven forbid, had been subjected to any Jim Morrison poetry, I just heard this rock pop stuff coming out of the transistor radio. And that was the level on which I enjoyed The Doors forevermore. So they're fine as long as you...
Yeah.
Is there a case of saying The Doors are the Smiths of the 1960s?
Yeah.
Ooh, it's a really difficult case there to is. Make.
No,
it's
in no, the
it's,
same
it's
way,
it's only got an hour, Matt.
The best record is a cover. That Jose Feliciano one's a banger.
Who else should be kicked off the Pantheon?
Well, Oasis Obs.
Well, they're not in the Pantheon, are they? No, they're not. I mean, they're wildly popular, and everybody knows that, you know, it stopped getting good at the end of Side One of Morning Glory.
The start.
That's one foot on the Pantheon, I suppose. So we're kicking off the Doors and possibly Oasis. Anybody else?
I don't know. Where is the Pantheon? What's the address of this Pantheon of which you speak? You
tell me. Acropolis Mansions. Yeah. Yeah. Athens.
You tell me who's in it. I'll tell you
what
I don't
so
like.
What we're saying is there is no canon.
I'm not sure. Well, I think there used to be. There certainly used to be. I'm just not sure whether one exists in the current age.
There were far fewer opportunities to listen to music at one point. Now it's because it's streaming everywhere. Everyone can have a go at being in the Pantheon for a minute.
Everyone got their own turn. Canon.
Yeah, I've got a canon. Yeah, it's brilliant.
It's a loose canon. It's
generator
a loose
canon. In the old days when magazines actually were getting launched, we would have a section called Loose Canon, which would contain all random things that ought to be
hold
raised.
That thought.
Absolutely, write that one down.
Past and present are going on simultaneously now, given because that's how technology is. Mm. In days of yore, you know, you had the present. That was all you had because the past was gone. There was no way of retrieving the past. It was gone.
Yeah, but we're only something like 100 years into the recording of anything at all.
Yeah. Mm.
So come back in 500 years' time when you can access all of it, absolutely all of it. And you'll have, you know, will the future floating brains in plastic jars of the year 2500, will they be jacking into Spotify version 9000 and going, they finally got the Beatles? Yeah. Listen, hey, our Norwegian Wood, what do you make of that?
They'll be listening to Sega and Evans and go, right, they got that wrong.
All right, then. In sharp contrast, one of the most interesting things we heard about lately is a fantastic new box set coming up called The Wag, iconic tunes from The Wag Club 1983 to 1987. The Wag was one of the great London clubs of the 80s. It was a centre of the fantastically pretentious soul and jazz funk scene. It was a magnet for musicians and general ace faces, from Prince to The Clash to Robert De Niro to LL Cool J. Like a lot of jealous provincials, I only knew about it from reading about it in The Face, and therefore I automatically hated it. But you listen to this record and you realise it was fantastic. Wag founder Chris Sullivan, who was also the frontman of Blue Rondo a la Turk, is an author, and he's a host of his own show on Soho Radio, so he's on our station too. He's compiled this compendious 53-track, 5-hour box set. There's everything here from Gil Scott-Heron to Roland Kirk to freestyle electro to early house records like Dinosaur, L's Go Bang. In a minute, we'll be giving it a going over, but first, from the album, here is Gwen McRae and All This Love I'm Giving. That was Gwen McRae and All This Love I'm Giving from the compilation The Wag, Iconic Tunes from The Wag Club. Mike, were you an habitué of The Wag in the 80s and London clubbing?
I totally was. I virtually lived there. I got lucky. My band played there.
What was your band?
I was in a terrible, terrible band called 5TA, who were assigned to Arista. We were given heaps of money because we made the kind of music that A&R men like. It's not the kind of music that people like. So we were never bothered with the boring part of having to go and do shows or anything, because the people didn't like us. They didn't want to hear our stuff. So we just stay at home.
This sounds like the producers.
It was, yeah, it was like that. It was very, very much like it's a Bialystok and Bloom kind of sitch, where we had mountains of cash, nothing to do. And Winston, the Wag's doorman at the time, would let us in for nothing because we'd played there once. So even though we had heaps of cash, we would save our cash on admission fees, amble into the Wag for the start of the evening, and just drink. For some reason, Malibu and tequila in the same glass was our big drink.
That's the 80s-est thing I've ever heard.
I know. It totally was. Sometimes, if I was feeling particularly playful, I'd pop a blackcurrant redoxin in there as well.
What was the Wag's thing? Tell us why it mattered or why it was good.
Well, I would say that it was educational. You know, I was saying earlier that we listened to prog throughout the 70s. That was what was going on. And we listened to punk throughout the kind of back of the 70s, the early 80s. And all of a sudden, we had this incredibly eclectic mix of music. So you would hear Roland Kirk, and then they'd play Shack Up by a certain ratio. And it would just kind of careen from one thing to the other. And it, suddenly you would have a club night where the music would be vary from record to record to an extreme degree that I'd never, well, I'd never been to that many clubs before anyway. But I've been to a lot of clubs since and they're very homogenous. This was really mixed. It was like being on Spotify. And we, it was, you know, if we're talking about 1981, 1982, that was very exciting and new.
Is this album an accurate document?
It's quite Proustian for me. There are tracks that are missing from my point of view that were essential, like John Handy's Hard Work would have to be on there, and it isn't.
There are more volumes coming.
When you're making a compilation album like this, you're obviously hamstrung by licensing to a certain degree, but there are some crackers. You know, that Mel Torme Coming Home, I was dimly aware that Mel Torme was a person. In the sets, I'd seen his name written down somewhere. I'd no notion what he sounded like. I loved that record, and I loved it. I didn't even know when it came out, but I started loving it in 1982.
Paul, you were on the NME in those days, weren't you? So 83 to 87, NME, and then into Q?
I went to the bike a few times. I was still on the NME, so I was on expenses, you know.
What are they, Paul? Tell us what they are.
I know, this takes me back. So I was still the kind of boy about town at that stage, just... pre-fatherhood and everything. The WAG was great. The music was interesting in the way that you were saying. For me, it was a bit like Eric's Club in Liverpool. I'd been a few years before.
Yeah.
You listened to what those DJs were putting together.
So what you're saying, Paul, is it happened in Liverpool first and Liverpool did it first.
Of course.
Okay, just cleared that up.
Better.
Yeah, so that's a matter of record.
It was just educational.
Yes.
In a very enjoyable way. With the WAG Club, I was going there, I suppose, more as an observer. It was a place where people went to be seen. Mm. Unusually for a club, it wasn't downstairs, it was upstairs, and it had a big window. In fact, it was in that stretch of Wardour Street below Shaftesbury Avenue.
Mm. Opposite Chinatown kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's still there, but it's now an O'Neill's Irish bar.
Yeah.
But the fact it was upstairs with a great big window, it was a bit like that 60s club, the Ad Lib, where all the jeunesse dorée of the swinging 60s would go and literally and metaphorically look down on London.
Yes.
It was a glamorous place. I mean, I can't say Robert De Niro was in there every night. He wasn't, you know.
He was probably waiting.
Bananarama. And that's probably where the song came. Bananarama were in there every night.
Yeah. When they weren't in the embassy.
Yes. Gary Crowley, Vaughan Toulouse, another big face in that. See,
Paul, I got the impression as an NME reader in my little provincial bedroom that the NME was kind of split down the middle between the kind of beret and Oxford bag wearing clubbers, and everybody else.
It was an anxious time for the NME because it was in the inky days of the NME, and what was hurtful was that having been the hippest publication on the planet. Its circulation was being surpassed by smash hits, this glossy teen upstart from across the road in Carnaby Street, and its hipness had been overtaken by the face. The WAG Club is very much the face in physical form.
Yeah.
That scene was really not what the NME was good at, although there were people on the NME, like Adrian Thrills and so on, who loved that scene.
Yeah.
But I remember vividly getting the first Smith's demos. Morrissey used to send me demos with that funny spidery handwriting. And luckily, thank God I wasn't an A&R man because I didn't get the Smiths, but I thought, I really hope they're big because this is just the kind of music that the NME needs. This is the kind of thing the NME can put on the cover and look like it actually believes in.
Yeah.
And within 2 or 3 years, that actually came to pass.
What? You mean you didn't want the Ian Penman 5,000-word semiotic discussion with loads of really interesting bits of type in it?
They were there. Yeah, I love them, but I got the feeling that the readers weren't feeling it, you know. But the Smiths saved the NME in those days.
Yeah.
And the White Club was the kind of thing that the NME couldn't quite... it wasn't physically equipped to deal with that kind of culture.
Yeah.
I think the thing about clubbing, that house music completely changed, and which it changed what the WAG kind of stood for, was that it wasn't supposed to be for everybody. You know, the whole point of clubs were that they were a place for like-minded subcultures to coalesce, whether that's Northern Soul, which you know, is brilliant, but one of the most, you know, whether it was kind of the original mod stuff, whether it's, you know, pre-house music,
yeah, you had
London
this notion
clubbing.
That you're part of an elite.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, so my little era of when I was actually going to clubs, so it was the Mud Club, the Embassy, the WAG, or Dirtbox, and that was it. And you saw the same people at all these places. In fact, sometimes in the same night, you would see the same people at all these places. Mm. And what? Even though you didn't know them, like I didn't really know Chris Sullivan, but I knew him to look at, to go, all right. And it felt kind of like, especially because I was some idiot from South London who had never been anywhere or done anything, it felt exciting and like I'd arrived somewhere.
Yeah. Well, this album is sort of 53 tracks and 5 hours or something. It's long enough to put on the Wag Club again in your house in its entirety.
I have been doing that for the last few weeks.
You were saying you were having a kind of soul jazz barbecues lately.
Yeah.
The album does get, much as I love it and I enjoy it, it was a surprise to me, there is a slight element of fast show jazz club to it, isn't there? There's nice. A few, there's bongos.
You say that like that's a bad thing.
it's better than Indie Club with Colon kicking the sun. Well, the album The Wag, Iconic Tunes from The Wag Club 1983 to 1987 is available for pre-order now and it'll be coming out on June the 10th. So there's your summer sorted. We're coming to the end of the show, and as ever, we'll be asking our guests now for their closing time chatter, the thing that's obsessing them this week, the thought-provoking, mind-capturing thing that they've been thinking about a lot this week. Paul, what have you got?
Having finished this 1,000-page Paul McCartney book, I turned the light relief to a 1,000-page book about the history of Detroit music, which I enjoyed rather more, actually, because it had more novelty appeal for me, I suppose. Yeah. The city of Detroit. I'm interested in cities. You know, I've written books about Liverpool and London and the music scenes, and I'm interested in this strange chemistry that whereby a city can breed so much music of different sorts. Motown is the most extraordinary place from the time of John Lee Hooker and the blues through, obviously, through Motown. I mean, even Aretha Franklin comes from Detroit. She wasn't even on Motown. That's how amazingly productive this city was. And then through the rock era, Alice Cooper right up to Jack White.
And does it go into kind of techno and does it move
into that kind of sphere? Covers pretty much everything that's happened in Detroit. It's one of these emblematic world cities because, as happens in so many places, cities grow up on the back of an industry, in this case the American automobile industry, then that goes away, you know, one day, middle of the night, it all goes off to China or something. What happens to this big city? What happens to the population of that city? Of course, terrible things happened in Detroit and then the backdrop of American race relations, and somebody makes an extraordinary point somewhere. They say, think of 1945, think of those tanks rolling across Normandy Beach. They were built in the car factories of Detroit. Mm-hmm. 20 years later, the same tanks are rolling down the streets of Detroit again because the race riots are about to kick off. And you just get the drama of this music, this happy Motown music, the really angry agit rock of MC5 and things made by the white guerrilla insurrectionists. It's all going on against the most dramatic post-industrial backdrop you can imagine. I thought it's, even though the book is episodic, it's written as a series of essays. It was just so fascinating.
What's it called?
Heaven Was Detroit.
Mike, how about you? What's your closing time chatter?
Currently, my new thing as of this week is Hooligan Boogie.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Wasn't that the sequel to one of those skinhead books?
Yeah, well, it evokes that era. It evokes that kind of, you know, when you've got your thumbs in your belt and your little elbows out and dancing to like Sweet or Suzy Quattro or stuff like that.
So tell us exactly what it is. Because
there's an Italian band called Juido, I believe that's how you pronounce it, and they played in London this week. And I noticed all these singsters and tastemakers and people that I look up to and get my ideas from going to see this band. And I thought, who the hell are they? What are they? Where have they come from? At first, my first impression was that they were kind of ironic, a bit like, do you remember The Darkness was sort of simultaneously doing and sending up 80s rock? And they appeared to be doing and sending up sort of Chin Chapman productions.
Slade, basically.
Precisely. But then there's a whole bunch of these bands. I found, as well, Hello Operator aren't quite that. They're very influenced by that. But there's a band called Shandy. They really are called Shandy. There's a band called Fuzzy Vox from France. And they are pure school disco, 1973, 1974, loons, tank tops.
Braces over T-shirts.
Juido have even got a band, even got a song called Tartan Trousers.
I must admit, I was furious to discover they were on last night because I couldn't go. And I've been wanting to see them for ages, Juido. So ideally, they'll play here lots more. Mm. My own closing time chatter is I've been immersing myself again in Nathan Barley, the terrifying sitcom, satirical sitcom of technology industry scenester hipsters, which is about 10 years old. The reason is I'm doing a panel about it at the Pilot Light TV Festival in Manchester this week with Charlie Condor, who played Jonathan Yeh, the editor who says everything with a question mark at the end. And just struck again and again by how much Nathan Barley, conceived as a comedy, now just looks like a documentary about now. People, you know, with geek pie haircuts and, you know, running around with spitting out the foolish buzzwords. Well, Jackson, yeah, keep it dusty.
I saw it as a comedy, and at the same time, I saw it as an aspirational career documentary. I really wanted to work at Sugar Ape. I still do.
Yeah, well, poor old Sugar Ape. Would a magazine like Sugar Ape still be going at all in the post-print world? It probably would, but they'd be charging £15 an issue for it, wouldn't they?
Yeah, it'd be really thick and glossy.
Yeah, and entirely funded by Nordine Defence Dynamics secretly on a kind of yeah, I mean, it's just what really struck me about Nathan, the central character, is although you're supposed to hate him, he is a bit of an idealist, really. He's sort of, there is something slightly lovable about him.
Yeah, if it's a bullying Pingu, he'd be one of my mates.
Yeah. Well, we are all Pingu now. I wanted to use... I wrote a story about Nathan Barley for The Guardian last year, and I wanted to headline it, Nathan Barley, A Warning from History, but they wouldn't let me. So that's our show. Thank you very much for joining us. You can hear us again at 9 a.m. next Sunday on Soho Radio. You can listen again to this show as a podcast on Audio Boom. Just go to audioboom.com and search for Big Mouth. And don't forget, you can also subscribe via iTunes. Just go to the podcast section of iTunes and again search for Big Mouth. Subscribe, share, tell your friends. It helps us get our numbers up. This week we were new and noteworthy, weren't we, Matt?
We were. That's the first time I've been new and noteworthy for about 30 years.
Absolutely, yeah. The last time I was new and noteworthy, it was for the Egg and Spoon race. Thanks again to our guests, Paul Denoyer, whose Conversations with McCartney is available now, and Mike Moran, who is available now.
I am fully available.
He's fully available. Thanks for listening to Big Mouth, and we'll see you again next time.